I volunteer at a food bank. Recently, I had a guest come through, and I noticed immediately that the way I responded to them was quite different from the way I would respond to other visitors. So usually I'll go into the hall and I'll say, "Hi there, welcome in. My name's Michelle, right this way." This time I came into the hall and I see a person who has a shaved head and is covered head to toe in tattoos, including a tattoo of a giant gun on their forehead. And so immediately I felt uncomfortable. And that discomfort resulted in me not venturing as close to them as I normally would and just saying, "Are you next?" To which he said, "Yeah." The moment I saw him, I created a story in my mind, which I'm going to be honest with you, was this person's probably a skinhead. He's probably racist. He's probably xenophobic, probably, all of the things, a misogynist. He probably thinks that, he's better than me. And it only took a couple of seconds for me to draw a conclusion that I was not safe in this space and that this person wasn't deserving of my energy. I'm drawing conclusions that are not grounded in fact. I actually don't know anything about this person. So this happens all the time. I create stories in my mind about people left, right, and center. It's about noticing them. And when I notice that it's altering my behavior, when I'm not being as inclusive, when I'm not being as fair about somebody, I have to change my behavior. And it always changes the outcome.
Hi, welcome to the Growth Mixtape Podcast, and I'm your host, Bob Mathers. We have one rule here. We're going to chase our curiosity way outside our comfort zones. The more uncomfortable and awkward, the better. We're going to talk to people you've never heard of doing jobs you didn't know existed. We're going to hear human stories about the things that connect us, what we can learn from one another, and what we can take away to apply to our own lives. These conversations might not seem to have a lot in common at first, but just like songs on a mixtape, you create something memorable and emotional. Today, I talked to Michelle Grakulski, a CEO and speaker who works with leaders to build more diverse and inclusive companies. She's one of Canada's top 40 under 40 and has been recognized as one of the top 100 most powerful women in the country. So yeah, she's kind of a big deal. I recently told a friend of mine that I was doing an episode on diversity and inclusion, and she said, "Yeah, that's of no interest to me at all." I appreciate her honesty, and it reflects how a lot of people are feeling about this topic. There's a lot of fatigue out there. And maybe that's why I love this conversation so much. Michelle is so different than any other leader I've heard on this topic. She shares personal stories of how growing up in an intolerant household and working in a psychiatric hospital helped her find her passion for this work. But even as an expert in the field, she's honest about having to combat her deeply rooted biases and stereotypes on a daily basis. You can't control your first thought, but you can control your second. I take a lot of comfort in that because I've made a lot of questionable decisions and told a lot of bad jokes. These conversations are never easy, which is kind of the point. Please enjoy Michelle Grakulski. All right, good morning. Welcome to the show, Michelle.
Thank you so much for having me, Bob. It is such a pleasure to spend time with you.
It really is. You know, you and I, just for a bit of context, have had maybe half a dozen or more conversations over the last couple of years. And I was trying to think about what it is about those conversations that I always enjoy so much. And I didn't come up with a great answer, but I do always come out of those conversations just feeling better. And I know that's not particularly eloquent or articulate, but I'm really excited to share one of our conversations with other people.
I feel the same way about you. I really do. And I hope that listeners are also going to feel just a bit better after hearing this conversation today.
Yeah, that's a high bar we've just set for ourselves.
Totally.
So let's see how we do. Okay, so you do a lot of work around diversity, equity, and inclusion. You have explained the difference between those three terms to me before. I know you have, probably more than once. I still am a little unclear. So let's kind of set the stage. I'd love to hear how you define each of those and why the distinction is important.
So I like to use an analogy of a dinner. So imagine you've been invited to come together with some other folks to share a meal, and you get to know other people around the table. You speak to them about their hobbies and their backgrounds, perhaps what they do professionally. You also recognize that there are differences around what generation they're from, or perhaps their abilities or disabilities. You notice that they might have been born in different parts of the world, or they have a different racial or ethnic background. You recognize that people don't have to match each other, and they don't have to match the person hosting this party in order to be given an invite. That's really diversity. It's about having differences at the table and recognizing that those differences are strengths. You also recognize that the person hosting the party took the time to ask everybody if they had any dietary restrictions. You know, do they have any preferences or any limitations? And then they ensured that people had something to eat, whether that's kosher, halal, vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free, dairy-free. You know, there's so many different ways in which we can accommodate dietary preferences and restrictions. That's inclusion. It's about taking the time to connect with folks and ask them, you know, what do you need? What would you enjoy? What, you know, barriers might you be facing? And then taking the time to provide something that everyone can enjoy and partake in. And then you recognize that everybody has access to the room. You know, they can enter into the building. They have a seat at the table. There's space if they're a wheelchair user, or for children, there might be a booster seat or a high chair. This is equity. It's about making sure that, you know, you're not only inviting people to this dinner and creating space for them to feel welcomed and ensuring they have something to eat, but that they can reach it. Because what good is being invited to the party and looking at this beautiful table set up and these amazing dishes if you can't access them, if you're just looking at them and having everyone else enjoy them while you are a bystander or an observer? That's equity. So inclusion is really about how people feel, right? It's about, do you feel welcomed? Do you feel valued? Do you feel like you matter? Diversity is about, do you feel like you can be yourself? Do you feel like you can be different, that your differences are welcomed here? And equity asks, can you access the full benefit of what's on offer here? Do you, or are there any barriers that might be getting in your way? So we need all three. You know, if you have diversity without inclusion and equity, you have folks feeling quite isolated. You know, they can be themselves, they're different, but they don't feel like they're a part of something bigger than themselves. And they certainly don't feel like they're being treated fairly because they can't access the opportunity, the promotion, the development, you know, programs. They feel like they are siloed off. If you have inclusion, but you don't have diversity, well, then you have conformity. You have a lot of folks who maybe are getting along and it feels warm and fuzzy, but they're not bringing differences of perspective, opinion, identity to the table, which would help us to innovate, be more creative, you know, to outperform. And without equity, we're operating in ways that quite honestly are unfair. We're not operating in a way that's ethical. So we might have people who are different and we might be treating them as though they feel that they matter, but we're not paying them fairly for their work, you know, or we're not removing any impediments to their career success or their career growth. So we have to have all three in order to have high performing organizations, but I would also say to have just and moral societies.
Hey, it's Bob, and I'm taking the Growth Mixtape on the road in a series of keynote speeches inspired by the stories of my amazing guests. At their core, these signature talks are about how to get you and your teams off autopilot and stop settling for small incremental improvements. This isn't going to come from spewing business advice. My podcast is full of people that have done incredible things, and every one of them struggles with self-doubt, imposter syndrome, and the crippling fear of judgment that holds so many of us back. They've also found ways through it by rediscovering their creativity, their curiosity, and the confidence to do scary things. Imagine the power of bringing these vulnerable stories to life, live and on stage, to help you and your teams hit your targets, find your voice, and be the rock stars you are. Book me for your next event at bobmathers.ca. Now back to the show. Okay, so that does help. So diversity is around being yourself. Inclusion is around feeling welcome, and equity is getting access to the space.
Yeah.
So having worked with a ton of big companies, which of those pillars is the weakest?
Oh, equity.
Okay.
Equity.
No question.
No question, because most folks don't understand what it means.
Mm.
There's a perception that when we talk about equity, we're talking about quotas. People think it's about checking a box and prescribing the kinds of people that will be given an opportunity, which for a lot of folks feels unethical. You know, it feels like, you know, aren't we supposed to be giving the best, the opportunities to the best candidate, the people who, you know, are the most deserving, rather than hiring people who are unqualified because they fit a certain demographic. In fact, when we do equity, diversity, and inclusion work well, we are not doing quotas. We are not trying to fit a box or hiring people because of their identities. What we're trying to do is to make sure that any of those biases or barriers that keep people out of our organization are removed. So we're not saying go out and hire this particular demographic, but what we are saying is how do we make sure that everyone who's qualified is aware of our roles so that we're posting these jobs in places where folks gain access? But also, how do we ensure that the process that they go through is inclusive and that the way that we're making our decisions are fair? And so a lot of that, when we build for equity, is taking a look at the process that a candidate would go through and all of the different decision-making points along the way to see, you know, where there might be biases that might hold an employer back from making a hiring decision. You know, an example of this we see within organizations that sometimes educational requirements are used to make employment decisions where they're not actually required for success on the role, in the role. Or it could be incarceration history might be a barrier that would prevent someone from getting hired when in fact a person's criminal background, you know, 30 years ago when they were a teenager and got into a bar fight has no bearing on the skills and contributions that they have or the potential that they have to do a great job. So when we are looking at equity, we're looking at fairness. We're looking to make sure that people are given a fair shot to not only come into our companies, but to succeed and thrive within them. So by far, equity is the one that is lagging.
Yeah. I mean, every time we have a conversation around this, Michelle, I can't help but reflect back on some of the hiring decisions I've made or the way that I've made decisions or the teams that I've built. And I'm just like, yeah, like it's not that I went out and purposely said, I'm going to go out and find a whole bunch of people that have similar backgrounds as me and think like me. But that's exactly what I did because it felt comfortable and it felt safe and I needed people I could trust. But it doesn't feel great, but at least I can recognize and go back and say, yeah, well, when I get another chance to do it, I'm going to try to be more aware of it.
You highlight something so important, which is that when we are in positions where we feel uncomfortable, we're doing something that feels risky, whether it's starting a business or maybe we're hiring a team, there's a lot at stake. We want to reduce uncertainty and get to a place where we feel comfortable as quickly as we can. And often for us, it's about let's go with who we know, rather than putting ourselves in this vulnerable position to say, no, I'm actually going to go out and take a chance on someone that I don't know at all. Particularly in today's job market, where you hear these horror stories of candidates who are actors who are playing the role of, you know, candidates interviewing for these roles or these AI generated resumes. And it feels scary as a manager, as a people leader, as a business owner to take a chance on somebody that you don't know. But it's worthwhile. It's really, really worthwhile because if you continue to do what you're doing, you're going to continue to get what you've got.
Right.
Which means you're going to get the same answers. You're going to have folks who agree with you. They're not going to challenge your thinking. They're going to come at problems the same way as you because you've been, you know, socialized in the same companies, the same corporate cultures. You have perhaps similar backgrounds. But if we can disrupt that by bringing in people who have a totally different lens, well, then we're going to come up with ideas that we could never have imagined.
I really like that. I'm sure I'll have no shortage of reflections and horror stories from my past as we move through this conversation. What I did want to ask you, though, it's so interesting doing this podcast and having the opportunity to have people on that I've worked with before, because I do a little bit of research and I go, you know, kind of digging into their past and I find things that I didn't know. So I went to your LinkedIn profile and just went back, and it strikes me that you might be one of these kind of annoying people that knew from an early age exactly what they wanted to do. They went to school for that thing. They got a job doing that thing, and they've been doing that thing for their whole lives and have always just loved doing what they do. But LinkedIn, of course, is also social media, so it's probably not quite that simple. So tell me a little bit about how you got into this line of work.
Well, certainly I'm annoying for lots of reasons, but this is not one of them, to be honest. So I actually wanted to be a clinical forensic psychologist. My parents were awful about preventing us from seeing movies that were not appropriate for our ages. And I viscerally recall in the early, I believe early 90s, watching Silence of the Lambs when I was way too young to be seeing it and meeting this character, Hannibal Lecter, who is this clinical forensic psychologist, and going downstairs to my Commodore 64, you know, shout out to all of us of a certain age and generation who understand what the Commodore 64 was, this big, huge, clunky computer in my basement that took forever to boot up. And I remember typing in, you know, probably in some obsolete search engine at the time, was a clinical forensic psychologist, and really understanding what might be the motives of this person, what might be their psychology, what might be driving them to do what they do. So I've always been really interested in what motivates people, what makes people tick, you know, why might people take the actions that they do. So I went into psychology thinking that that's the path that I was going to take, and worked in a psychiatric institution one summer early on in my undergrad, where I had the opportunity to really see what it's like in this kind of field and recognize that there was a disproportionate overrepresentation of Indigenous people, of racialized people, and of people who've immigrated to Canada. That's what I saw. You know, I saw there were a lot of folks who are from underrepresented or equity deserving communities in our nation. And I started to ask myself, why? You know, why is it? Is it that certain folks are born with a predisposition, and so that's why they're overrepresented? No, actually. A lot of people are dealt a pretty crummy hand. They experience systemic discrimination. They're more likely to face, you know, food insecurity and homelessness, to be underemployed, to be underpaid. This lit a fire under me. You know, why is this? And how do I become a part of the solution? That's what put me on the path of EDI. I started studying it in the lab. We looked at why people discriminate. And what we learned is that often it's when folks feel poorly about themselves, when they themselves have low implicit self-esteem, when they don't feel good about their own life track, when they don't feel deserving, when they don't feel like they matter. That's when they tend to hold prejudicial thoughts. That's when they tend to take on discriminatory actions. And that for me just built a lot of empathy for folks to say, you know, when people are hurt, they hurt others. And how do we try to create the conditions where we can help to open people's minds, open people's hearts, and recognize that you don't heal from hurting others, right? You really heal from extending empathy and compassion, not only to others, but also to yourself.
Wow. I had no idea that about that origin story. That's so interesting. You know, as you were talking about that, Michelle, I recently had a conversation. We recently had Clarence Kakachi on here, who is an Indigenous leader in the community, has an incredible story, heartbreaking. And we talked about, you know, the generational trauma of the residential school system here in Canada. And we talked about a whole bunch of things around that. But one thing that he mentioned that always kind of stuck with me is that people have to be ready for this conversation. I was thinking about, so how would that relate to a corporate environment where you've got a whole bunch of people, maybe they're on a spectrum of readiness, right? How does that work in real life when you're talking with companies and leaders?
They certainly are on a spectrum of readiness. You know, we have folks who are social justice warriors who are spending their evenings and weekends out there, you know, really championing justice and equity. And that's beautiful. And then we have a lot of folks who think that this work is working against their best interest. They feel like they are going to be discriminated against. And so they're actively resisting this work. And honestly, sometimes trying to gain support from others to join the kind of anti-EDI movement. You're kind of hearing a lot of slogans right now, particularly in the States, like, you know, go woke, go broke, or whatever. And so people are actually quite emboldened now to speak out against this, where 10 years ago, that was not the case. You know, people didn't agree with us, but they didn't say a whole lot. To be honest with you, I'm so grateful that they are. What we're trying to do is we're actually trying to create space for differences of perspective and opinion. And so that means creating space for people who don't understand this work, who don't agree with aspects of this work, or who might be in a different readiness level or place with regard to certain parts of the work. And I do find that, you know, for example, I find a lot of folks have come a long way when it comes to gender equity. You know, I have a lot of men, for example, talking to me about they have daughters. And they don't want anyone telling their daughter they can't be a pilot or a construction worker or whatever, right? That they should be whatever they want to be. But they're struggling when it comes to gender, sexual orientation and the use of pronouns or transitioning gender. And that's where they are. And sometimes it's related to religious beliefs that they hold or life experiences that they've had. And my job is not to convince them that what they believe is wrong. My job is to create an open space where they don't feel judged, but that they can explore how they've arrived at the conclusions that they've arrived at, and then decide how they want to intentionally move forward. And usually the way that conversation goes is people agree that everyone deserves to be treated with dignity and respect. And while they might themselves not choose to change their pronouns or change their gender identity, they will agree to use someone's name in place of an outdated pronoun, or to use to change the pronoun when referring to somebody. So you can be inclusive without having to change your beliefs, but you can modify your behavior to create a space that feels more inclusive or accepting for someone else. So I refuse to lose hope in those who say they're not with us, because I actually think a lot of them are. They just don't know that they are. Just another example, and I'd love your thoughts on this, Bob, as you know, I think you've shared with me and with your listeners that you identify as a white heterosexual man. White heterosexual men feel right now like they're misunderstood, that they are, you know, that they are evil in some ways, or that they're out there propagating so much bias and perhaps misogyny, or that they're the root of a lot of the harms that we're trying to overcome when it comes to EDI. And people are not even giving them the chance to show who they really are, right? There's no benefit of the doubt, that there's this automatic label. And when I have conversations with white men and they're sharing this frustration with me, like, people don't get it. They have this label. They have this assumption about who I am. They're not giving me a chance. I share with them, yeah, exactly. That's exactly it. That's how folks feel who are from equity deserving communities, where because of our gender, because of the color of our skin, because of our accent, because of you know, an assistive or mobility device we're using, people have come up with a story about who we are without actually giving us a chance, without getting to know the unique person that is across from them. And so that feeling of I'm misunderstood and I've been labeled, I think can be a powerful catalyst to say, I don't want to do that to anybody else. I don't want anyone to feel that way. I really want people to feel like when they're with me, I'm withholding assumptions, I'm withholding judgment, and I'm creating space to get to know them for who they really are, rather than coloring, you know, in the picture with Bob's a white man, he doesn't get it, he's not going to champion women, which we know is not the case. So I think that this this backlash actually can be quite a moment of introspection for folks to realize that the ways that they're feeling might actually give them insight to help solve these problems where people are being held back or overlooked, counted out, stereotyped because of one aspect or a couple aspects of who people think they are. I love your take though.
Well, yeah, I was reflecting on that a little bit, Michelle, before this, because my friends and I, who are kind of a bunch of middle-aged white straight dudes sitting around talking about this, the thing that comes up most often is that some of them work in big companies. And they're really nervous about saying the wrong thing or asking the wrong question, seeming insensitive, using the wrong pronouns. So what I think they most often do is just kind of shut down, like avoid it. Maybe because they're kind of like me, they're in the autumn of their career, as we say. So they're just hoping to fly under the radar, not make any waves, not make any dumb mistakes. I don't know how well-founded that fear is. Like social media is not real life. Like if you say the wrong thing, you're not going to get gaslit and canceled in a company. And that's sort of the story that we tell in our minds. So it seems to shut down conversation instead of kind of opening it up.
One of your superpowers, and we were talking about this before we hit record for the listeners here, is you're so humble. You approach every conversation with a curiosity and a desire to learn. You never carry yourself as the person who knows all of the things, Bob. And I think that that is a superpower of yours that not only benefits you, but I think can benefit all of us when we're coming into these conversations about EDI, which is to say, you're at some point going to encounter something you don't know about, and you're going to use the wrong term. You're going to put your foot in your mouth. It's about how you move forward from that, accepting that you're not a perfect human being. Mm. And I think when you hold yourself in that place of humility, it makes it easier to hold other people in that space too, where when they step in it or they say the wrong thing, you're not immediately jumping to judgment because you recognize that it's going to be you and it has been you. So how do you want someone to respond to you when you've used the wrong term? You probably want them to come at you with some compassion, right? Recognizing that you're on a learning journey yourself. I think it creates the conditions where other people feel like they can be more courageous themselves and maybe have conversations that they're afraid to have or try new terminology that they've never used before, knowing that if they do mess up, it's likely that they're going to be met with that grace and compassion on the other side of it.
Yeah. Wow. I love that. And thank you so much for those kind words. There's a good reason why I don't come across as somebody that has all the answers, because I 100% never do. So I never do have them.
Me too.
Yeah. One of the things I'm learning that I'm just loving about these conversations so much is I've had people on talk about being in a better listener or being more creative or overcoming imposter syndrome. My going in assumption is that these people have got this all figured out and they don't make those mistakes anymore. I remember talking to Bob London, who does a lot of work around being an authentic listener. And I said, everybody listening, like my wife must, listen to this conversation and go, that Bob London, man, his wife must be the luckiest woman in the world. He is always open and he's such a great listener. And Bob Mathers, why couldn't you be more like Bob London? Why couldn't you be a better listener? And what I'm discovering is it still takes a lot of work. So I guess I'm wondering, even for you, Michelle, who does work in this space all the time, do you still find yourself, doing something and be like, oh my God, I can't believe I just said that, or I thought that, because it's always amazing to me how much work this stuff is. And it seems like to be decent humans, it should be automatic, but it always seems to be a lot of work.
You are so right. You are so right. And you might think that, the more you work on being inclusive, the less you will notice these moments of biased thinking or when you fall prey to a stereotype. But in fact, you're becoming more aware of it. One recent example, I volunteer at a food bank. And recently I had a guest come through who was waiting in the hallway for me. And I went to go and welcome them in. And I noticed immediately that the way I responded to them was quite different from the way I would respond to other visitors. Typically, I'm a very bubbly person. I pride myself in being quite warm and non-judgmental when I meet people. And so usually I'll go into the hall and I'll say, hi there, welcome in. My name's Michelle, right this way. This time I came into the hall and I see a person who has a shaved head and is covered head to toe in tattoos, including a tattoo of a giant gun on their forehead. And so immediately I felt uncomfortable. And that discomfort resulted in me not venturing as close to them as I normally would and just saying, "Are you next?" To which he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Okay." And then he followed me in. We're looking at the shelves, and rather than what I typically do, "Okay, over here, you know, this is where we have pasta sauce and canned tomatoes, and then we have soups." I said to him, "Yeah, these are all over on this shelf. They're worth 2 points." So I'm withholding, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not engaging. I'm not leaning in. I'm not acting in the same kind of warm, talkative way that I normally would. And he's also being quite standoffish. He's not saying a whole lot. He's just grabbing cans and putting them in the cart. And in that moment, I realized that this interaction, the tone for this interaction started the second I saw him. The moment I saw him, I created a story in my mind, which I'm going to be honest with you, was this person's probably a skinhead. He's probably racist. He's probably xenophobic, probably, you know, all of the things, a misogynist. He probably thinks that, you know, he's better than me. This whole story started the second I saw him. And it only took a couple of seconds for me to draw a conclusion that I was not safe in this space and that this person wasn't deserving of my energy. Based on what? I'm drawing conclusions that are not grounded in fact. I actually don't know anything about this person. And so I decided in that moment to start again. And that's what this is all about. Just like with when our kids, when they fall off their bikes, we say, "Pick yourself back up and just start again," right? We just start again. So in that moment, I said to him, I noticed you're going for like the Elfagetti and stuff like that. You know, do you have kids?" I was kind of making an assumption, but I kind of thought he did. And he's like, "Oh yeah, I have kids." And I said, "Are your kids as picky as my kids? Because my kids won't eat these things. They'll only eat these things." And he was like, "Oh yeah, my kids are total jerks." And we had the greatest time. He had me in stitches. He had an amazing sense of humor. We were bonding over the fact that our kids only eat things that are beige and bland. And by the end of the interaction, you know, I think that he felt a completely different way about coming into a space when you're quite vulnerable, you're relying on a food bank. There's so much emotion. There's so much fear. Often there's a lot of shame of people having to ask for support like this. And rather than feeling judged and feeling that sense of hostility, I hope that he felt cared for. And I hope that he felt that someone took the time to treat him with dignity and respect. So this happens all the time. I create stories in my mind about people left, right, and center. It's about noticing them. And when I notice that it's altering my behavior, when I'm not being as inclusive, when I'm not being as fair about somebody, I have to change my behavior. And it always changes the outcome. I think it's about going within, really, and just starting to get curious about what's the story I'm telling myself about this person and how do I just park it, right? And try to see them for who they really are. Try to get to know them on the basis of what they tell me and what, you know, what unfolds rather than this preconception that I'm holding in my mind about them.
Wow. That is an amazing story. I was just thinking as, you know, hearing that for the first time and other people hearing it for the first time, be like, "Michelle, he has a frickin' gun on his forehead." Like, I mean, it's an amazing as that story progresses, the amount of kind of empathy and how it turns out. But I think everybody's like, "Yeah, I get it." Like, I can't imagine anybody seeing, "Hey, look at that guy. I can't wait to go talk to that guy. But he seems like a really sweet guy. I'm going to go talk to him about the 44 on his forehead."
100%. And it's not the tattoo I would ever want. And it's not the tattoo I would ever encourage anyone to get. But I also recognize we all make decisions in our lives. You know, yeah. I have one of those fun lower back tattoos that we all got in the early 2000s or late 1990s that I wish I could get rid of. And I would hate for someone to make decisions about 40-year-old Michelle on the basis of what, you know, 19, 20-year-old Michelle did. And I can also imagine that when you have something that is so visible to somebody, whether it's a tattoo or maybe it's a visible disability or maybe it's a person's skin color or maybe it's something we hear like an accent, and you're going through life and people are making immediate judgments that are negative on the basis of that, you become a bit hardened, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it not only alters your worldview, the world is tough, people are awful, right? But it also creates a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. When you're used to people shutting you down, when you're used to people backing away or not greeting you warmly, you start to enter those spaces with walls. people feel those walls, right? And then they get more distant. So it's this kind of perpetuating cycle that continues to occur in people's lives. And I think we all have the power to break that cycle. All it takes is just deciding that you're going to suspend judgment and treat that person almost like a blank canvas.
One of the things I think I've heard you say before, Michelle, is that you can't control your first thought, but you can control your second one. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. So the first thought is often a product of stereotypes. And in fact, there's been ample research that shows this. When we are rushing or when we lack sufficient information, our brains go to stereotypes to inform the impressions that we hold for people. So whether that's with regard to age, oh, this person's going to be slow to learn, or they're not going to be able to use technology, or whether it's with regard to national culture, you know, or race, this Asian person's going to be great at math. We hold these stereotypes that have been informed largely from media, you know, who's been cast in certain roles in movies and television, and sometimes based on life experiences, which are limited and narrow and don't represent the full breadth of the diversity within communities. So the first thought is going to be a biased thought. It's going to be a stereotypical thought. The second thought, though, can be one where we can break free from that bias. It's one where we can ask ourselves a question with curiosity and non-judgment that would make it more likely that we see the person for who they truly are. So in my example of the food bank, my first thought was skinhead. My second, third, fourth, fifth, all the way to 20th thought was also stereotypical. So this was not a great example, but somewhere down the line, I asked myself this question of, am I being fair? Am I being fair to this person right now? And actually I wasn't. So we have the power to reframe, and it doesn't have to always be a perfectly articulated thought. Sometimes it can just be a pause. It can be a deep breath that you take to recalibrate and bring yourself back to being mindful, to being fully present in the moment. Kids are really good at this. I have a 5-year-old and a 7-year-old, and they notice difference all the time. I'll never forget taking my son to Target when they used to exist. And he looked over at somebody and he pointed and said, "That person's black," and very loud. The person could hear, right? And there was no judgment in his voice. He wasn't like, "Mom, that person's black." You know, there was no subtext of "that person is not as good as me as a white person." There was no judgment there. It was just an observation. And so, you know, the way that I responded to that was, yeah, you're right. You know, people come in all different colors. Isn't that beautiful? That makes life interesting. And it's a wonderful thing to have difference. And I want all of us to have that kind of reaction to difference, which is to say, yeah, it exists, but there's no judgment on it. There's no better than, less than. There's no, this person is more qualified, or this person is safer, or this person is smarter, or this person's a better leader because of the differences that we're noticing. It's just a difference. These kinds of things can really help to bring us back to being much more mindfully aware and much more fair in the way that we're interacting with other people.
Yeah. I've found this myself. My kids are older, but I'm always amazed at how that generation seems to be much more empathetic and kind and kind of more open. I know they have biases and they're susceptible to stereotypes too, but it seems like the younger you go, you're reminded that, yeah, we weren't born with this stuff. It's really beautiful to see, because I didn't have kids till I was 30, and I didn't until I saw kids and saw that like blank slate that I realized, oh yeah, that's actually pretty amazing. And the way that they talk about people with, you know, gender fluidity, or people of, you know, different backgrounds, very, very different than the way I grew up.
Same here. And I think a lot of people assume that if you get into the work of equity, diversity, and inclusion, that you're probably the child of social justice warriors or people who've been activists. And that couldn't be farther from the truth for me. I was raised in a very homogenous community where I could count on one hand the number of students that were racialized. My father, even though he's an immigrant to this country from Italy, harbored some incredibly discriminatory views around a number of different communities and groups. And he was very vocal growing up with us about how he felt about different cultural communities. To this day, he is anti-immigrant, even though he immigrated here himself. He has a grade 3 education and landed a great job at General Motors, making a great salary that would not be possible today. And yet here he is harboring these kind of discriminatory views. I, up until the point that I went to university, didn't understand how that upbringing had brainwashed me to think in certain ways about people. I started meeting people from different groups, different communities, recognizing that they are not what I was told they are. So for me, coming from an environment where I was raised to be quite close-minded has helped me to empathize actually with a lot of folks who are grappling with this work, realizing that many of us were born into conditions where we didn't have a lot of exposure to difference, and we were in families and in situations where we were celebrated for believing things that were quite harmful. So now it's about unlearning them and doing that in a way that, again, is quite humble and non-judgmental and gentle with ourselves, because, you know, none of us are perfect. We're all unlearning. We're all on this journey. And if we can just give ourselves a little bit of grace, we're much more likely to stay on the path, even when, as we talked about earlier, we kind of step in the mud. So that having that background, I think, can really be helpful, because you can kind of see clearly how people end up on the road that they are, harboring some of the beliefs that they do. They've been a fish swimming in the water, not aware of the water around them.
Oh, I love that. So how would you, you know, I think it's interesting. We've known each other for a few years. I think we met initially sort of in the, I don't know how to describe it. It seemed like there was a surge of DEI work after, for example, George Floyd. And a lot of companies trying to invest in this. Oh, we need to have more conversations about this, because it was kind of coming from their teams, their people. They sensed that there was something happening that they needed to address, but then it kind of dies down. And so I see it kind of flare up, and I'm wondering how you see that in the corporate world, because it seems like, if I'm a cynic, it seems like people would kind of rather not deal with this, but kind of deal with it reactively. And all of a sudden they find budget for this kind of work, and they do it for a couple of years, and then it kind of quiets down, at least from as an external observer, that's kind of what it looks like. How would you describe the state of DEI in the corporate world today?
I agree that it's been waning over the last couple of years. Mm. I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that companies who jumped into DEI or EDI weren't really clear on what they were solving for. Mm. You know, they didn't take the time to really understand what was going on inside of their own companies. They threw a bunch of money, they put together committees, and those things were really programmatic. They were nice, they were feel good, but they didn't change anything in terms of their culture, because they didn't have a good enough understanding of what the particular problems were inside of their organization. It can, though, happen where you can put a spotlight on the measurable, impactful things that can shift, that will not only make your company more inclusive and diverse and equitable, but are also going to make it much more engaging and high performing and reduce turnover and increase your ability to attract top talent. And often those things are not extremely costly. You know, so for example, one organization we worked with, we heard from employees saying, I just don't feel like there are fair opportunities to get ahead in this company. I don't feel like I'm going to get promoted. So we heard that from the survey. We heard it from focus groups. We didn't know why until we started getting into their policies. And what we learned is that their development policy, their advancement policy, had all kinds of clauses that would prevent a person from being promoted or given a development opportunity, like a conference or a training program or a mentor, if their business unit had reorganized, if they had not exceeded expectations in the previous performance cycle on their performance review, if they were on a performance improvement plan. And the list was so long. So we took that policy, which was written many years ago and probably sat on a shelf and people forgot about it, and we brought it to the executives of the organization and said, you know, here's a barrier. People are not going to get access to the opportunities that they need to learn and grow and thrive in their roles and be better performers if we have all these conditions. You know, a person might not have an exceeds expectations performance rating, maybe not because they're not a great performer, but maybe that year they broke their femur, or maybe they had childcare constraints, or who knows, any number of things can impact a person's performance, but it doesn't mean that they don't deserve a mentor. And in fact, having a mentor could have helped them in that year to be an exceeding performer. It could have really been the difference maker. So knowing what they were solving for enabled them to remove that barrier, change the policy, which therefore increased people's feelings that they are included and treated fairly. And over time, we're going to see more people not only stay in that company, but also move up because they're getting access to training and support. So what I say to people who are moving away from EDI is, you probably didn't know what it was in the first place. You probably didn't have clarity on how it was going to benefit your company. You probably didn't know what the root cause issues were for you. And once you figure out what those things are and put the right plan in place, you are going to see that this pays off. And it doesn't just pay off for Indigenous people. It doesn't just pay off for new Canadians. The changes that you're going to make are going to make your company better for everyone.
I love that. You've given me so much to kind of reflect on, which is exactly what I've come to expect from every conversation with you, Michelle. This has been amazing. Before we go, you just did your first TED talk, and I'd love to know, we could have a whole other complete episode on that. I'd love to know what you came away with from that experience, and what was the thing that you learned that you did not expect from that?
TED is a tough platform because, first of all, you don't have notes. You have to know your talk. But you also, in order to resonate with people who are in the audience or people who are listening or watching you thereafter, you have to be deeply present. And so that for me was such a learning of knowing your stuff, but also being able to be deeply present and connected to the audience in the moment. What struck me after I completed my talk was the feedback from students in the room. I did this talk at the University of Waterloo, and it was primarily students who were in attendance. And afterwards, I had this lineup of students who wanted to talk to me about the stereotypes that they feel they've had to battle against thus far in their career journeys. A lot of them, for example, shared that having been born outside of Canada and having an accent that might sound different from mine, they felt that there was an automatic assumption that they were not strong communicators. Meanwhile, some of these people speak 5 languages. And yet there's a presumption that they're not strong communicators. Oh my goodness. And how often we want to give advice to the applicant, to the candidate, to say, okay, here's what you need to do to prove that you're a strong communicator. Write your resume in this way. Show up for your interview in that way. When what we should really be doing is going to the hiring manager and saying, hey, what assumptions are you making about a person who's multilingual? What assumptions are you making about a person who might have an accent that, you know, an Indian accent, for example? And how might that interpretation differ if it was a British accent? There's an accent, but the meaning or the judgment often is quite different depending on whose accent we're listening to. So it was heartbreaking to hear these firsthand stories from students about bias and discrimination, but it galvanized my desire to continue going, working with employers, because if they can catch this and if they can de-bias themselves, ask these questions, park these assumptions, then they're going to give a fair shot to folks who are deeply qualified. You know, speaking 5 languages is going to help you no matter what workplace you're working in right now. We're working in a multicultural and increasingly globalized environment. And so how do we help employers to see the assets, the strengths that talent bring, as opposed to seeing difference as a liability?
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I've been fortunate enough to do is work with a lot of new Canadians as they come here. They might have businesses established in other parts of the world and come here, or they might have come here to be an entrepreneur. And when you hear those stories, of picking up your life in some cases, terrible circumstances, and coming to Canada and starting a business or moving your business and bringing your family. I'm just struck by the fact that like everything you've done in your life is harder than the hardest thing I've ever had to do. Like nothing I've done in my middle-aged white straight guy life has been as hard as 10 things you did before you got up for breakfast this morning. You know, so it's just, it's very humbling. And if you want resilient people that can figure shit out, you might want to consider people that have had to do a lot of different things to get to where they are.
Absolutely. We see the same thing with caregiving. People, employers, managers looking at a person who has children, or maybe it's elder care, thinking that that's a sign that they're not going to be as committed, they're not going to be as hardworking. We can reframe that in exactly the way that you have highlighted for us, Bob, which is to say, look at all the skills and strengths that they probably had to develop as a caregiver. They're probably deeply resilient. They're probably pretty good at emotional regulation, because anyone with little kids knows how hard it is to keep your emotions in check when they're having a meltdown. They're probably good at time management and prioritization. I mean, I think when we start to unpeel the layers of the onion, we realize that these differences are a source of strength. And it's not just a cliche, you know, slogan that we should put on our company banners to say, we believe in the power of diversity. But it's really about understanding that, yes, when people have different experiences in life, that they're bringing different skills and perspectives that genuinely are going to help us as an organization to be better.
Well, this has exceeded my expectations, Michelle. As I said, every conversation that we have leaves me feeling, I don't know, better, warmer, a little conflicted, because it does tend to bring up some things from my past that I'm going to reflect on and say, yeah, that doesn't feel awesome. But God, I just really take so much away from these conversations. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much too. And don't be hard on yourself about those moments in the past, right? Because that's how we learn and grow forward. And also, hey, congratulations, you're not a sociopath.
Yeah.
It's a really healthy sign when we look back and think, I wish I knew what I know now. But it's in the learning that we grow. So keep on going.
I'm not a sociopath. Well, maybe we've got our soundbite for the promotion here. That's perfect. That's just what I needed to hear today.
The Growth Mixtape podcast with Bob Mathers is produced by Bespoke Projects. Music by Je M'appelle Walter Cronkite. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to follow and rate us. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so that more people can find us. If you want to connect, you can find me on LinkedIn using the link in the show notes.